Let me turn it over to Dr. Bach, and he'll introduce our guest for the morning. Lord bless you.
Well, welcome, everybody. You know, I sometimes
wonder what it would be like not to have hope. And the Lord really does change the frame with which we live our lives. And without that, I would have all kinds of reason to despair. So we're going to transition and talk about life that takes place in a space that the church tends to be slow to address, but that at the same time is essential in thinking about whole discipleship and about the way that we live. This is the period from 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, where most adult people spend most of the times of their lives, and which sometimes the church is slow to directly address. And my guest today is David Ridley, who was the founder of Invesco. Is that correct? What did Invesco, what did they do?
Invesco, there was a bigger firm called Invesco. I founded actually a predecessor to Invesco that I sold my firm to Invesco. What we did was we were in the business of funds management. Someone has to manage the money. And so that's what we did. You know, so clients, pension funds, endowments, foundations, even individuals through our mutual funds.
So are you a glorified bean counter? Is that what?
No one has ever accused me of being a bean counter. There'd be a lot of laughing around that.
Okay. All right. So, and David, we asked you to come be a part of our Faith and Work Chapel to discuss kind of your take on being a professional in the business world who's interacted with the church. Let's talk a little bit about your church involvement. When did you come to the Lord, and what's been your association with the church?
Well, I'll tell you, actually, it was through the prayers of a very godly woman in Oak Cliff, where I grew up. I didn't have a great family life. My mother passed when I was 10, and my father was absent a lot, and this woman sort of adopted me. She had a son my age, and she prayed and prayed, and through that, I believe through those prayers, I found Jesus one night laying in my bed in my apartment in Oak Cliff, and I jumped out of bed and drove over there. And she introduced me to the seminary. So seminarians would come over and teach our Bible study. And so I've been coming down here since 1970, I guess.
Oh, wow.
Every now and then listening to speakers.
So most of the campus wasn't here back then.
No, it wasn't.
You go back to the trailer that was the book room and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, I saw a lot of that. My father-in-law, I ended up marrying my wonderful wife of 38 years, and the way I met her is her father had moved to Dallas after becoming he was a career naval pilot, and he came here to go to seminary. So once again, seminary steps in.
Interesting. So let's talk about your experience as a businessman in the church. As you look at this, and you've been associated with the seminary for a long time, you've been a believer for a long time. Summarize your experience as a business person engaged with the church when it comes to how the church engaged with you in your business life.
Can I just sit here and be silent?
Ooh.
My experience, it goes back in all being negative around the church, but it really goes back to me having no roadmap. Okay, it was sort of left to be figured out, and there was this conflict in my head, is what I'm doing important or not? And, maybe I should be in the ministry, because obviously if I was a godly person, I would get in the ministry. And I think there's a huge need for pastors to encourage, their parishioners to get into the workplace, and to that's probably the biggest mission field in the world is the workplace, as you mentioned. So there is a lot of that going on now that didn't exist. In fact, I asked a man in my church one time, would you consider mentoring me? And he literally laughed and said, why would I do that? And I won't name the church. He was an elder that many, many years ago. It just wasn't the thing to focus on the business.
So you've seen a change.
Oh yeah, I've seen a change. My church now, Antioch, is where I go now, and we followed our grandkids right over there, like we always do.
Yep.
they're actually asking me to do this.
Evangelistic program, church growth program.
Yeah, my wife, my wife follows him, I follow her is what the way it really works. I'm a real spiritual leader, aren't I?
Yeah. So you now speak to this. You're retired, and you're taking up a second life, but you haven't left your business experience. And you walk in, and what do you talk about when you go in and do this? Since you had so much help along the way.
Well, I'm transitioned. I'm not retired, by the way. I didn't think I'd mind that term until I actually did it, and I hate it. But I am transitioned, and it's funny. God, and I don't want to sound cliche-ish here, but God took me on a journey. There are now books written about these things, and I just laugh when I read them because I watched how God took us and just formed us and taught us those things. Now, I was in Germany recently reading this book, and I was just laughing. I thought this guy was sitting in our meetings. So God actually took us and sort of coached us along the way. And the way that resulted, I was asked at the end of my days at Invesco Real Estate to step up to the bigger company and take charge of like 6,000 people in terms of teaching them around client engagement and things about building anybody can build a business, but to be around for the long term is difficult. So teaching them how to do that. And so that curriculum turned into my talk I give now around the country to various universities, and I'm being asked to do that at a few churches and Christian schools now.
So you managed 6,000 people at one point?
Well, that's anybody who says they did that, you question their real salvation. you actually manage maybe 10 people who manage others, and it cascades out. But yes, I was asked to sit on the actually co-chaired a management committee for that entire team, and then the whole thing around client engagement. Yeah.
And your sense has been that what we do at seminary is actually well suited to help you do something like that. Is that kind of the bug that you've caught?
Yes. My vision is to help the seminary, but help the church understand how important that mission field is called the business place. And that there is a way. My talk is entitled Building Enduring Organizations, because not everybody's starting a company. They're in a group they manage. So building that, but also winning without regrets. There's a way to do that. And God came to me this way and to us this way, where I watched a team of gentlemen who started a very, very large business. Again, I won't name it, but I watched them get off the blocks really well, but then I watched them fail. They weren't winning without regrets. They had lots of regrets in virtually every case, divorce and alcoholism and all kinds of things. So we sat around a table in our conference room one day, myself and my partners, and we said, we're not going to do that. We're going to do it in a more balanced way, and family, wife are always going to come first. So that's the story.
So you began to address some of the values that you think your Christian faith was teaching you and inject them into the workplace. Is that a fair summary of part of what was going on?
Yes, very fair summary.
And so some of those values are?
Okay, so let me just, if you don't mind, cut me off. I'll ramble a little bit here. But what God really taught me, it started in a hotel room in Houston, Texas. Okay, I had started my business. I think that was a miracle in itself. And so I go to Houston. I'm 2 years in. This is 1985. And I go to Houston, and I'm meeting with one of the most powerful real estate brokers down there. And he was going to bring me transactions I could invest with my one big client. We had one client for 10 years. That'll give you religion, trust me. And so he looked at me after the day was over. We're at dinner, and he had all his little analysts with him. And he looked at me, and I'll never forget it. He said, David, do you realize you don't have a chance to make it in this business? You don't have a chance. Who are you to compete with Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan and all these big companies? And I sat there and looked at him, and I remember chills going up and down my backbone. And the one thought I had was I agreed with him. He's probably right, you know. That was the longest walk I'd ever made back to my hotel room, and I got in there, and just imagine me sitting at this desk, and I took a sheet of paper, and I wrote every line. I filled it with my fears and my weaknesses, my shortcomings, every one of them right there. I'm not smart enough. I don't know how to sell this. I don't want to disappoint my boss, who's an extremely powerful Democrat, friend of Jimmy Carter's. All these things, you know. And I disappointed him every day, I guess. But so we just, I just took that list and I just got on my knees with it and I just gave my entire company to Christ. And I said, if you will please move me out of this. I remember wanting to call my old boss and get my old job back. But I said, if you'll just move me out of this, but if I'm going to stay in this, you be CEO, I'll just be the door guy. I don't care what I do. And I'm telling you, that night was a transition point. I went to work, walked through Bryan Tower, the halls of Bryan Tower, downtown Dallas, and I was so relieved. I didn't care what my boss thought anymore. I wanted to please him. No more pressure. Creativity returned. That was the beginning of the point in time when I knew that I didn't own it anymore. It was him. And the amazing things that started was I started meeting these new people who I couldn't hire the right people, who are still my partners. I retired with them. I mean, that's a God thing. So over time, again, I didn't have a book to read, but slice by slice, I started learning. And what I learned was there are certain health factors. If you really want to build a great enduring business, it's really about your health, all about your health. And I can now name some books you can go read, which are incredible books. And the factors that make that up are things like a values-driven culture, which actually sits on top of many other things that have to be right. There may be 100, but you have to get several of them right. Those are things like a team-based ethos, low ego, humility, all these kinds of things, very understandable direction, empowerment, how you measure things. All these things are what people are designed to want to do. And we got those right at Invesco, and we never lost a partner, never lost a client. We were just, it was a supernatural thing. So people wanted to work there. It became the Invesco family. And we grew globally. You know, we ended up managing $75 billion around the world and number five in our space. And I can take no credit for it. And it came through, and just think, how do you love people in the business place? My opinion, you love them through creating a healthy environment. And sure, I've sat on the couch and cried with one of my guys and his wife because we thought he was going to die of cancer. Those things happen. But the day-to-day environment, it's about having a healthy environment at work, the day-to-day loving people. And I always thought about it. God commanded us to love God with all your heart, soul, and mind, but love others as yourself. There's a lot in that last one. And I happened to work for a real bad guy my first 5 years out of college, so I knew what the other side looked like.
And so you're in the midst of going through this. You're wrestling with this. You're wrestling this as a believer, and you're struggling to find help. And yet if a pastor or someone had reached out to you, you would have gone there in a nanosecond, right?
In a nanosecond. If they could have talked about that human equation and how to apply God's love in the business place.
So what I want you to talk to us about now is, so we've got people here who are training for future ministry, and we're going to have them well trained about, you know, how to teach the word, and here's the content of the Bible, and, you know, all very essential stuff. It's stuff that also you're looking to hear from them. But what else can they do that would be a help to someone who was in your position? What advice would you give them as to how to connect with the business person?
I think inadvertently the message can be sent that if you're not in vocational Christian work, then you're kind of a step down. I think it needs to be sent, not a discouragement, even if it's a subtle discouragement, but actually a vociferous encouragement to get out there. That's your marketplace. That's where you're needed. That's where your gifting is. Mm-hmm. I wasn't gifted to be a pastor or in a lay ministry. So I think just going out and really encouraging your folks to get out there and do it right. A lot of pastors, they haven't ever really been in business other than maybe summer jobs or whatever. So get involved with some of your folks. Go to work with them sometimes. See what they're doing. Listen really closely. you all are all brilliant people, and you'll pick up on it really, really well and start feeling the pain that's out there, because it's a messy, messy environment, as I know the church is too in many ways, but it's a messy, hurtful environment. So to understand that more and encourage them and get people into your, get the, and I'm seeing more of this faith and work environment where churches are getting their pastors to speak to it, get folks into those kinds of programs. So they'll have a game plan. Coach Tom Landry, I'll never forget, he said, you know, these guys finally learn how to play football, then they retire. And that's a little bit how I feel about myself. You know, I finally kind of figured it out, and it was time to transition. You know, I think it can be very powerful if you get to the folks while they're young and they're wanting it. It would be great.
So I find that one of the things that gets in the way of building these relationships is, if I can say it this way, and I'll let you elaborate, the pastor is intimidated by the businessman, and the businessman is intimidated by the pastor. And so that gets in the way of their connecting. How do you break that down?
And we're all intimidated by our wives, so that's how that works. You know, honestly, I haven't seen that. Probably not, because my pastor is just attacking me around the idea of doing this for them, and not only for the business people, but for the church staff.
So the situation has completely changed from where it was when you started.
Yeah, I mean, maybe God put me in a place where that's not happening. I'm mm-hmm. sure it happens, but I think that leadership always is, I don't care if there's 10 people under you or 50,000, it always starts with the leader. So if your pastor is not seeing that vision, you need to be praying for him and talking to him about it, because without it, it won't happen.
But let me just remind you, we have the mic set up as we normally do, so if you have a question for David, do feel free to step to the mic and talk about this. So what are you doing now? Talk us a little bit about what you're doing now.
Well, it's funny. Candy and I took the opportunity to travel. American Airlines told me I've gone around the world 360 times and to the moon and back 38 times. So you would think that's the last thing I want to do is travel. But Candy did. So we spent 2 years going around the world, spoke in China 10 times. It was just a lot of fun. We had offices there, and it was fun. But the time came when the Holy Spirit talked to both of us and said, okay, that's enough. That was fun, but that's enough. It's time to plant yourself so that you can start seeing the traction that you need to get in your now your lifetime work or ministry. And so we did, and it's just been incredible. Every day lunch is full for 2 or 3 weeks, being approached by several ministries, and various things are coming about. So I'm hoping I don't mess it up. I'm hoping that I can develop. I've got a really good talk, I think, but now I need to develop deep dives into some of these topics. So I'm looking, I've got some things, but I'm looking for more meat there. And God willing, he'll introduce me to some audiences, and we can slowly iterate this into this work and or faith and work. And as I told you, I didn't even know what faith and work was when I met you. I just started learning there is a movement. I was too busy working to really know that.
Yeah, but it dovetailed both with what you had seen, what you had experienced, and what you were looking for.
Totally. It's changed my world. Just hearing about it, and it's changed the way I'm going to be giving my talk.
So let's talk a little bit about what that actually looks like. There are a lot of companies that wrestle with creating a healthy environment. And the thing that has struck us at the center has been, as we get close to these companies and we talk to some of these people who are leading these companies, they are saying to us, we think you have some values that we need in our business place. And the failure to have this, they put it in raw numbers terms, costs us billions of dollars. How does that work? I mean, what are they talking about when they say that? What are they wrestling with? What do they want and need? What does the workplace need?
Some people are getting smarter around this idea of human flourishing, as you've taught me to use those terms. Some people are getting smarter there. And as I said, it's all going to emanate from the top. So if those folks are getting this vision, they're starting to ask questions. How can I get this advantage? This is probably the biggest single advantage today that successful companies can still tap, and it's getting it right around their human resources. So it's turning into a big deal. Now look, here's corporate America. It is so frequently managed by CFOs who ascend into the CEO place, okay, the CEO position. I call it the quants dilemma. Probably shouldn't tell people that. But the idea of corporate health, your people, is hard to measure, right? And so forget it. In this old fallacy, if you can't measure it, it doesn't matter. I grew up under that. Totally false. There's now studies you can go to. McKinsey, they had a study that shows, and thousands of companies surveyed, that if you focus on your execution capabilities equal with your company's health, you're 4.4 times more successful in all their studies. Okay? But you can't measure it. You have to watch it. I call it the paradox. We always called it the great paradox. If we manage our people right and their conditions right, the health right, guess what? Profits went up. And we created, it's all about search for differentiation. We created some amazing things that were hard to copy. One's called amazing stability. And your clients get to know you intimately over a year. So they talk to your admins, they talk to everybody, and everybody tells the same story. So that's what they're seeing. How these bean counters measure it, I have no clue. But I've read books on it, and it's really fascinating to see the difference. The way I measured it is people want to work there, and they have, when we had the family feel.
So they have a sense of why they're doing what they're doing. They have a sense of what service they're performing, what needs that it meets. They feel satisfied and flourishing in the midst of that. They feel like that they're there for more than a paycheck. They're there because they recognize that the service that they perform actually has value to people. Is that part of what you're talking about? And the people they work with are understand their roles and their functions in relation and care about one another as people.
In every survey I've ever seen, paychecks are down the list. It's 2, 3, you know. It's liking who you work with and feeling like there's a purpose and you feel good about it. And I can tell you, there's not any people out here as old as me, but when you start to retire, now that I'm retired, the most important legacy I have is what we did together as a team. And man, do I wish I could have done some things different now, having the hindsight there. So it's huge.
Okay, we've got some people on the mics, and this is the South. We ladies go first. Go ahead.
I was waiting a long time.
It doesn't matter.
So I had a question. When I was towards the end of coming here to seminary, so this last year, my company was implementing a lot of programs. So there was a shift in leadership. And in fact, the CEO of the company is a believer. He went to church with me, loves the Lord. And so it's a big company. And what I saw was that there was an attempt to put out new values into the company, you know, talking a lot about integrity and about cooperation and so on and so forth. But one of the things I observed, which I thought was interesting, is that we had a system whereby people could say send you an electronic thank you or appreciation for some work on a team that they if we had a project to get out or whatever. And I knew that it existed. I think everyone did. I typically managed my relationships personally, so a thank you and so on and so forth. But HR came one day and said, look, we want you to know that, by the way, not only can you do this, but when you do this, then management sees that you're a team player. And I promise you, within like 2 days, I got like 3 electronic thank yous from people. Thanks, Trish, for this, leading on this team, or for blah, blah, blah. And I was like, it's funny. Like, I felt that what we were doing was a kind of behavioral training that was like putting on values that weren't necessarily real to the people. And so I watched the last, year and a half of interaction as all of these programs were coming down, and I thought, how do you make this stick? Because it's like sort of putting sticky notes of pretense, like this is what we are like, but I'm like, But underneath, I was like the same, aggressive ambition. We're all gonna to make sure that we're, it's all at play. I'm like, nothing about change.
You better measure it.
Right. So we had good, smart, measurable goals. But anyways, point being, I was just curious as to how do you build that into the company, really, so that it's something that's real, and it's not something that's just we're all wearing T-shirts of sweetness, but underneath we're kind of.
I haven't had a better question than that in all the universities I've been to, including Stanford, including Georgetown, Texas. I want to really compliment you. What a great question. Okay, here it is. It's easier to build when it's new. Like I started with myself in an admin, and so over time we evolved to this. But when you have a company that's really kind of broken and it's a big company, it's harder. But here's the problem. The very top person who really has maybe 8 people, I don't know, reporting to him all the way down, it has to be truly authentic or it will not work. So the CEO that gets up and spouts these words that are, you've come up with, and everybody there knows it's just words. It has to be authentic. That person has to model true humility and has to model vulnerability, or it won't work. And it has to, and just remember that A word, authenticity. They will know. People get to know you very well over the course of a year. And you may go 30 years with them. So that's the number one thing to make it stick. And when we were building our values, we had to spend a lot of time thinking, okay, that's what the book would tell us to say, but that's just not real to our heart. Here's what's real. So we went with what was real to us. And so our value prop, out of 8 things, 7 had to do with health. 1 was we had a great research group that had a unique process. Only 1 of them was technical.
And I'm hearing in the between the lines of that businesses tend to function with an eye, obviously, on how they perform, how they execute. But what you're talking about here has it impacts execution, but it has nothing to do with execution. It has to do with relating to people.
Amen. That's right. You say it absolutely right. And it's like that great paradox I mentioned. Guess what? You do that right, your profits grow. Yeah. Everybody's happy, including your stockholders. But we had this big argument when I was first sold our firm to Invesco, and I would sit in these meetings, and this guy was talking about the number one constituency is our stockholders. I'd say, no. I thought, I must be missing something. Your number one group is your people, your employees. You get them right, then your customers are really happy because you have great people who are working with you and are stable, and then your stockholders benefit.
So, I mean, this is crucially important because what you do is you get to know the people that you work with as people. You care about them as people. You care about them in their families, in their life. You don't just see them as a lens through which to perform a task.
That's right. The first thing I did when we were starting our business in 83 is I studied Southwest Airlines, not to give them free advertising here. But why did people want to work there? And to this day, I get on, hey, you happy here still? And it's amazing, what they're able to create. If you look at the stats, it is truly phenomenal. And it's driven by their health. And that's how many people, 85.
You're talking about relational health, basically.
Relational, yeah. Relational health. The business of business is people. That's what they say. Hmm. And how can it be any? And the guy who runs it, he used to run it, the founder, Herb Kelleher, I'm not sure as a Christian or not, but he got love. Mm-hmm. It's the mm-hmm. love airline. He did it right. Mm. And it's not what you say, by the way, it's what you do. Mm-hmm. And he did it right. Mm. Yeah.
So I'm a farm boy from South Carolina, and I've counted a lot of beans. So from one bean counter to another. Thanks for sharing with us this morning.
Bean counters are good.
The question I have is in regards to corporate chaplaincy. What's your take on the corporate chaplain, and what place would he or she have in your vision?
I think badly needed. It's interesting you say that. One of my best friends I was talking to last night, and he's going to transition before too long, and he talked about wanting to be a corporate chaplain. And I thought, wow, what a great role that would be for him, because he went here. He put himself through here at night as he worked. But anyway, very, very much needed. There's a conundrum, though. Fortune 500 company or traded on the stock exchange, and you have every religion known to man. And there's one group that does it really well, I think, is this, I forget the name of them. They have chaplains for the workplace. You probably know them. And you've got to be careful on how you approach it, because you've got to offer this service to everybody, right? But then it's a by permission basis. You'll end up in relationships where you can really open up and really have an impact. What we did was I hired a guy, again, this is before the chaplain type programs were around too much. We hired a guy named Dr. Ron. He's a believer. He had a psychology background, had a practice, but we had him move over into, or he moved himself over, I guess, into the corporate world. His job was to facilitate us where we had problem areas within our company. We had hurt feelings or people not interfacing well, and to dive in and meet their needs, both business-wise, communication-wise, and spiritually. And that worked really well. But in a way, in corporate America, it kind of needs to be below the radar sometime. You know, so it's got some finesse involved with it, but very much needed.
Kevin.
So as a Christian leader, especially in the workplace, how do you balance setting a standard for excellence and creating excellence in the workplace with the need for grace, knowing that you're working with sinful human beings? How do you address that tension in leadership?
Sometimes very, very imperfectly. And I'll tell you a story. One of my Christian brothers where I worked, he's with me for 25 years, as many of them were, he said to me one day, he says, David, do you remember the time you told me you either get this done or I'll find somebody else? I said, no. Man, did I really say that? And then when my assistant was retiring, who I just asked to come back to work for me, by the way, because I'm floundering out here. But during her retirement, she was up there giving me praises, and she didn't know what she was saying. But she goes, you know what? But he always said he was sorry. You know, but here's the deal. People know your heart. They know your heart. They know who you are. And so everybody knew my heart and how much I loved them. But we had a burning desire to win. We're created to win, right? We're created to have fun and trust God, and we enjoy winning. You know, we don't want to lose. So you've got to work hard. And there's a whole topic on family balance or work balance that we don't have time to go into, but we wanted to win. When I do my college talks, I always start off by saying, hey, raise your hands if you like to lose. And I said, because we're going to form the Losers Club right after the talk outside, and we need a head, you know. So to win, there's fires in your belly. We're all broken. That's something else I'd always say at meetings. Who's not broken in here, you know? But they know. They forgive you. But you have to have excellence. Today is the most competitive environment that's ever existed in the world. Knowledge is rampant. Smart doesn't count. That's a commodity. It's easy to find smart people. It is about a lot of things that are different if you want to win today. And you've got to work hard. And how you manage that with your family is the key.
So there's a tension between pushing for excellence and if I can say it this way, demanding performance. And the idea of the person doing the pushing and the managing, showing enough that they care that the challenge can work.
Yeah, because think of all the families you have. This went through my mind every day. All mm-hmm. these families. We had 500 people. That really meant maybe 2,000 people. Mm-hmm. And if we didn't compete smartly and be accountable and put the hours in to do it, we're letting everybody down. Not to mention, think about your testimony if you just kind of took it half-heartedly and joked all the time. What would that look like? I mean, that spoke to me big time. So people want to see an ownership and a passion, or your testimony's out the window as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think we're on this side now. Go ahead.
Okay. As I was standing here, I realized my two-part question is actually now a three. It's mainly the difference between the way my father, who is manager of a research department in a big company in Korea, versus me. who want to open up a counseling clinic, it's a difference between corporate and self-employed mostly. So from my father's history in his in the work in the technology industry, he has been known to be like one of the most honest and nice men in the industry. Still having people that who worked under him, like giving him like special treatments here and there every time he goes visits them. And there's me, who don't exactly see himself as a people person, want to open up a counseling clinic. So in a sense, what would you see as the biggest difference between working corporate versus working self-employed? The second part of that is how much easier and how much harder is it to exemplify Christ in a corporate versus self-employed? Third part is there any way for there to be an in-between corporate and self-employed?
Yeah, that's again a very good question. In fact, can you please lighten up on the questions? No, it's a very good question. And here's my opinion. We're all gifted differently, right? And that's the body of Christ it talks about in Corinthians. We're all gifted so differently. When I found Christ, Christ in the workplace, when I finally gave it away in that hotel room, the next hire I made, I paid twice as much as me. And my boss says, this guy crazy? The other guy that I hired after that, I was paying him $20,000 more a year than me. Okay, I had the security to do that, okay, to go ahead and get great people around me because I knew that God owned this and that the competition wasn't in here, it's out there. Because we all are in competition, by the way, in this capitalistic society. So we had to offer an excellent, excellent product. And there's a principle that I learned many years ago. We named it, and it was called IQ compounding. The only way to get there is to work with other people. God designed us to work with other people. That's how Jesus did it. And we're designed to be with other people. And so if you create the right environment, the obligation to dissent, constructive conflict, you walk out of the room still loving each other, you have the right people around you, you're smarter than the competition. So it's surrounding yourself with the best talent you can possibly get. Even if you're self-employed, find that group you can get involved with. And it's the same in public or private. There are different systems where teamwork is less important. If there are star systems, a real estate broker, you know, he's the star, that's fine. Most businesses are more competitive and are more complicated, and they need to have, I shouldn't say more competitive, more complicated, and you need that team. So I would create a team if I could, because we're not designed to be alone. Even if you're not in a corporate, you're by yourself. And celebrate your uniqueness, because you're not a gregarious person or someone who, you know, is great with crowds. That's fine. Get someone who is with you or around you. But just celebrate who you are.
Yeah, and I hope you're hearing that some of the skills that are being required that we're talking about here are skills that also work and function in building communities in churches and that kind of thing. There are things that pastors and businessmen can share in their interaction with each other as they're each trying to serve people in the space where they have them. And I hope you're also hearing that there is a ministerial heart that is in the businessman that can be tapped and nurtured by the pastor. Okay, here.
Hi, thank you for being here today. I've had the great joy of working in several different corporate environments. I've had the chance to work in a retail environment, work in like a call center environment. In my experience in retail, give you a quick story. We had 8 supervisors in this particular store. 7 of them were Christians at that, and they were seminary students. They were going to that one in Fort Worth, that other seminary you probably heard of. However, with that same team of supervisors, with men and women who were seeking to be led by the Lord, our store was number one in the nation for 9 months straight. In that time, we saw people led to Christ, like on the floor of the manager's booth in my store, by my buddy Bart, who was a great evangelist. What I found working in that environment was being a good nurturing team leader and having a high standard of excellence opened the door to witness. Not just down into my employees, which we did, but also up into the higher corporate structure. So my question in all of that is, have you seen that opportunity to share Christ with those above and below in the workplace? And how do you do that? When I did that 15 years ago, or 12 years ago, it's very different than the corporate mindset that exists now with the, there seems to be a hostility to Christianity. I worked at a large insurance company. It was not safe to be a believer working there. Where 6 years before, at a store in Fort Worth, I had complete freedom to talk about Christ. Maybe to speak to some of that difference, maybe what you've seen that's changed, and how can we learn to be good, impart our church members and ourselves to be good persons in that kind of environment? And sorry, that question's heavy. I know you wanted lighter ones.
You're testing me here. No, another great question. In fact, this conversation I had last night with this friend of mine, seminarian at night and working full time, he said, you know what, we're talking about being this very topic, he says, if I'm too overt, I'll get fired, point blank. So it has gotten much more hostile. But here's the way I see it, and I know that there's a lot of talk, and I've learned to call it by permission. But you can imagine, as a founder and a CEO of a business, how I could just trample somebody, you know, got them cornered on an airplane, start witnessing to them. It has to be a God deal where, because of who you are, they want to know more. And sometimes it may not come to a direct witnessing of Christ. It's not exactly, you don't get to that point, but you get far enough and someone else harvests it. So it is truly, in the corporate world today, it can happen, but it's got to be by permission, and God will tell you when it's right, and he has to attract him anyway, as it says. So we need to relax about that and just let it happen. Now, I will tell you, over time, some of my most rewarding things are when I've had people come to me and tell me how much they were influenced by me. One young guy I invited to go to a Bible study, he was my second employee, played for SMU. He was 90% deaf, interesting guy. And brilliant. And I invited him to this Bible study I'd started downtown. And he looks at me and says, by golly, you don't bring religion into the workplace. And he's looking down at me. You know, he's 6'6", and I'm looking up. And years later, he comes up to me and hugs me, and he's just this vibrant Christian. You know, and that's happened over and over again. I didn't get to harvest it. I got to lead my boss to Christ once. You know, that was great. But it's just be open and go through the doors that are given you.
Over here.
Yes, I just thought it was interesting that you said that today being smart is now a commodity. And so I was just wondering, from a Christian perspective, as we're supposed to minister to those who are marginalized, what does that look like in the workplace, especially with people who might be losing?
Yeah, good question. You know, it's in my experience, everybody's smart or they wouldn't be there, you know, in a lot of these positions. I have friends who are really suffering, strong Christians suffering because they don't feel like they've done enough in the business place. They feel like they've been wasted, their talents wasted. And in my belief and the way I counsel that is, look, God has put us on a path, and we need to be happy with that path we're on and really work that path and spend a lot of time in prayer. But learn to be on the path where God has put you. There's other paths I would have rather taken personally, but he put me on this one, and that's the one I'm going to take. There are people far smarter than me and more equipped biblically than me. They look like the perfect person who ought to be doing what I'm doing, but he has them on a different path, and they need to have peace with that.
Last question here.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Ridley and Dr. Buck, for taking it. So I have a professor. And he argues that worship, as seen in the New Testament, really doesn't happen in a church service, but it's actually seen as happening in the day-to-day, which I think is very interesting and touches exactly what you're talking about, faith in the workplace. And as Christian leaders are called to equip the saints for the work of ministry in their day-to-day life, like that is their mission field, you touched briefly on a few points on how to build relationships with business men and women, you know, get involved with their life, you know, let your business person be their show and tell, like go to work with them. What were some other areas you can touch on just on how to build the relationships with those people regarding, you know, building those relationships with the business men and women? You mentioned, you know, encouraging them to, this is your ministry, empowering them, and then going to work with them. But I think you mentioned a few more that I missed.
Okay, I'm not sure exactly what I said, but here's one of the things that God has put on my mind here is what I learned early on was, yeah, you need to be excellent, right? And so when you get in an environment and you're competing with your colleagues, that's big time in many places. What I've learned, and I mentor young guys all the time, that's a hobby, is don't compete with them. Compete against standards. In fact, be servants to them. Help them. They'll never forget it. And again, it's not what you say, it's what you do. So absolutely, and sometimes it's really hard to love some of the folks you're working with that are highly political and really are not prone towards good health or hygiene in the marketplace. But be a servant and compete against standards, be the best you can, and trust God with it. And that I found very important in the marketplace. And I'm not sure I hit exactly all you were after there.
Well, David, I thank you for coming in and chatting with us, kind of giving us a sense of what a Christian businessman's heart is like and the way of thinking about relationships with them. And I hope that you get the sense of encouragement that a person who's in the business, who's in the business world, is a person who's approachable. You can get a glimpse of what their, and should get a glimpse of what their 9-to-5 life is like, so that you can begin to think about how you teach into that with the values that not only operate in the context of a person's private Christian life and the corporate Christian life of the church, but also works in corporate life as well. I think that's all very, very important, and it's very transferable. And in the midst of that, you demonstrate the value of Christian faith, which then can lay a groundwork of credibility for other things that you also want to talk about. You know, the scripture says that if you don't handle earthly things, how in the world can we entrust you with spiritual things? And so I think that's an example of this kind of principle that we're talking about. Let me close this in a word of prayer, but let me make an announcement that I forgot to make at the beginning, which is there are internships available at the Hendricks Center for students that walk into these areas, walk into the area of giftedness, that talk about writing into these kinds of spaces and into these kinds of topics, that kind of thing. If you're interested in that, check the student board and you can find out details about what an internship with the Hendricks Center can be like. It's a little bit different than some of the other internships that are around, so we would love to have you be a part of what we do. Let me close this in a word of prayer. Father, we do thank you for just the privilege we have of being made to serve. You know, in Genesis 1, the first assignment you gave to people was to tend the garden well, to be good stewards. And being good stewards means that we not only engage in the tasks that you give us that allow us to serve one another, but also that we relate well to those around us. And certainly it is the gift of your Spirit that enables us to do that well. May we draw on the resources that you give us. May you form and shape a heart in us that desires not just to perform a task, but to serve the people around us in such a way that we make the world that we live in a better place, and in a way that is honoring to you. We ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.